Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Several years ago, Charlotte set a goal to end all traffic deaths by 2030. But from 2008 to 2012, there were an average 39 deaths from crashes and pedestrians being hit by vehicles. And in 2020, there were 81. The numbers are rising, not declining. In fact, this is happening nationwide. In 2019, more than 6,000 pedestrians were killed by vehicles, up 46% since 2010. So is Charlotte's goal realistic? What's causing the rise in traffic fatalities, and what can be done to decrease them? We're joined by several people who have either studied this or are working on it. Eli Portillo has been looking into the Charlotte statistics. He is Assistant Director of Outreach and Strategic Partnerships at the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Good morning. Dr. Wes Comfer is an engineering research associate at the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill Highway Safety Research Center. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. And Charlotte Mayor Pro Tem Julie Iselt is the chair of the City Council's Transportation and Planning Committee, and she is here as well. Good morning to you, Julie. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mike.
Let me start with you, as a matter of fact. The goal is to eliminate traffic deaths altogether in Charlotte by 2030. It's an admirable goal, although it does sound, in light of what I just had to say, it does sound impossible, particularly because the numbers are rising here and around the country. So when and why did City Council set this goal?
So we set the goal, I'm not exactly sure when, but we have been working on what we call Vision Zero, which is a international plan, for the past several years. We approved it a few years ago. And that is not only about getting people to slow down in an effort to keep people safer, not just in vehicles, but on pedestrians as well and cyclists. But it is also about building complete streets, because we know that street design is a problem as well. And it's a challenge. It's a challenge for every city, because traditionally, historically, streets have been built for cars so that they could move fast. So you're talking about redesigning streets. And then of course we had COVID, which just didn't help at all with, because there's more space on streets now to drive and speed. And
well there was. There, I think traffic has returned. Dr. Comfer, from what you know from your research, and I know that you look into road design and all these kinds of things that we'll be talking about in the course of this hour, do you think that this Vision Zero plan, whether it's here or elsewhere, is achievable?
I want to believe it is. And in fact, there are several cities throughout the United States that have achieved a Vision Zero. The question is, what exactly have they done to do that? Digging into more details is a little bit complicated, because traffic safety is a complex system, and there are a lot of different factors at play: political, legislative, legal, the way that drivers behave, the way that vehicles are designed, the way that roadways are designed. But there is evidence both here in the United States and abroad that it can be done.
And Eli, in 2020, in Charlotte, there were 81 deaths, if I'm right about this, due to traffic accidents. And that number was up from previous years. And that's, we've been doing this, trying to move toward this Vision Zero, no traffic deaths at all, for several years now. What's driving the uptick? Do we know?
So I did a story on this, actually in partnership with WFAE and the Charlotte Ledger for our Transit Time newsletter. And, you know, what CMPD attributes the causes to: speeding, number one, excessive speed, also a lack of seatbelt use. There's also, you know, the possibility that distracted driving, texting, and playing with your phones while driving is a cause. And that's similar to what the federal authorities say is driving traffic fatalities nationwide. You know, earlier this fall, Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg said it's a crisis nationally. Got 20,000 people who died on U.S. roads in the first half of 2021. That's up almost 20% from the year before. And that is the biggest 1 year increase that they've seen in federal statistics for a 6 month period. And I think a lot of people expected traffic fatalities to fall during COVID because we were driving so much less. But, you know, the fact that the opposite happened really, I think, indicates that we have a more serious structural problem, a longer term problem than just, you know, one cause like distracted driving. If it was just cell phones, we could probably fix that more easily, for example.
Dr. Comfort, Eli brings up an interesting point because at the depths of the pandemic, there was virtually no traffic on the roads locally or even on the interstates for a period of time there. And last year during that pandemic, in which people drove less, vehicle crashes were down by more than 13%. That means the number of people injured in collisions also declined by nearly 16%, according to the DMV. But the number of people killed in those fewer vehicle crashes last year increased by 13% to 1,658. That sounds counterintuitive. What happened there?
I think a lot of what you're cluing in on has to do with speed. That was something that was also called out in the NCDMV report. And I'd like to offer just a point connected to what Eli mentioned related to speeding. I think it's important to think about speed itself as being fatal. So a lot of the ways that crash reports are coded deals, if something is marked as being speed related, that can be in excess of the speed limit or in excess of safe operating speeds. But it's worth considering, especially since you brought up pedestrians and bicyclists earlier, the fact that speeds above 30 miles per hour or so are just extremely fatal for people outside of the vehicle. The chance of a fatality has gone up quite a bit. And one thing we did see during the pandemic was there was just quite a bit of speed, especially with congestion decreased on the roadways. There was more opportunity, I think, for people to get out there and open it up.
Well, I was going to ask you, I don't know whether you're not a psychologist, but I'm sure you look into some of the psychology behind this. When the roads are clear, as they were during the pandemic, you could do the speed limit and get there unimpeded. Why did people feel the need to go faster, much faster in some cases, than the speed limit when there was nobody else on the roads?
You're right. I'm not a psychologist, but I will say one thing we do know a little bit about is that the way that the roadway is designed does have an impact on the way that people perceive speed. And so if you have narrow lanes, Julie mentioned complete streets earlier, you know, that's an element that is sometimes part of the complete streets program, is narrowing lanes. If you have trees on the side of the road, if you have a lot of just visual friction that can mentally cause people to slow down. Whereas if you have wide open roads, very few cars on the road, large lanes, unlimited access, I think it could just be a trigger for people to go faster.
You're not old enough to remember this, but I am. During the gas crisis during the Carter administration, the National Highway Administration lowered the speed limits on interstates. Sometimes they were posted at 85 miles an hour, and they lowered them to 55 miles an hour. And lo and behold, the number of traffic fatalities decreased commensurately. We know this, that speed kills. That's not just a slogan on an advertising campaign. It does. We know this intuitively. We know it from experience. Is that because of the skill of the driver, that going faster makes it more dangerous? Is it because of the design of the road? Is it because automobiles are really not designed in America, or weren't then designed in America, to go as fast as we were going? Safely, doctor.
Well, there are a few different factors at play, right? So vehicles have gotten safer over time. So I think was that in the 90s that the national speed limit legislation was lifted?
70s.
I know the speed limit dropped in the 70s, but I think the restriction was lifted in the 90s, right?
Okay.
The late 90s.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. And we saw fatalities jump back up, right, at that point in the 90s. So even since then, vehicles have gotten a lot safer. And, you know, pre-90s, they were still getting airbags and seatbelts figured out. So the ability for someone within a vehicle to survive has increased over time. But as you hit on as well, we're dealing with kinetic energy. So just the energy that's transferred when a large vehicle collides with something else, and we're dealing with impact angle. And a lot of studies have shown that depending on the way that two vehicles collide, it could be a very minimum injury. That's why if you have, say, a roundabout that cuts off the sort of angle impact type crashes, and you have more maybe rear end type crashes, those tend to be much, much less injurious because there's just less kinetic energy transferred. There's less energy going into people hitting each other. However, if you're not in a vehicle, again, I'll just mention this because I research pedestrian and bicycle safety. That's where I think we really, really need to make strides in this country is pedestrian and bicycle safety. If you're not in a steel cage, you are susceptible no matter what angle you're clipped at, no matter what angle, or no matter how the intersection is designed. If you're not protected, if you don't have safe clearance there, you are vulnerable to being killed by a vehicle.
Is speed the problem? From what you know, Eli, through your research, et cetera, in Charlotte, is speed the major problem?
So CMPD did say speed is the number one cause that they're associating with fatalities right now, which tracks with, again, what federal authorities are saying. And I don't know about you, and this is anecdotal, but I feel like I've been seeing speeding like I've never seen before in 12 years of living in Charlotte over the past year. I mean, I'm not the world's slowest driver, but if I'm going 60 on Independence, like this past week, I'm getting passed by people easily going 10 to 20 miles per hour faster than me, you know, I feel like I'm driving like the proverbial little old lady, and I'm within 10 miles of the speed limit. And that was not the case pre-pandemic. And I think at this point, we don't know enough to say, okay, yeah, this is definitely what's happening. But I just feel like in the last, you know, year or so, I've just seen more speeding and more reckless driving in Charlotte than I've seen in the previous decade plus that I lived here.
I think, Julie, you can speak to that because I think you've heard from your constituents about that.
Oh, this is probably my biggest beef right now. You know, we can have all these new things in Charlotte, but at the end of the day, we got to fix what we have. And speeding is probably the number one complaint I have from people. I hear it. I live close to the Center City. You hear it at night. I don't know where all these cars with mufflers that have been, you know, altered. I don't know where they all come from, but a lot of cities are having this problem right now. You can hear them racing at night. We're getting complaints from all over town about this issue. And it really is to fix.
And one thing that people have asked me about is, well, Charlotte's grown a lot, so isn't this increase in fatalities just a byproduct of that? Well, if you look at population growth over the last 10 years, we're up, you know, about 20%. If you look at fatal accidents, we are more than double the average that we were doing a year or a decade ago. So clearly something else is at work here, and it's not just population growth.
So last year, the Charlotte, I'm sorry, go ahead.
If I can add, I just think that we have changed the culture of driving in this city. You know, I remember a time when you'd sit there and you'd see a police car sitting on the corner waiting for speeders, and we don't see that anymore. And people know they can speed. They know they can go through red lights. How often do you just watch somebody go through a solid red light, stop signs all the time, running right through them? And I just think there's this attitude of nobody's going to stop me from doing it.
When you mentioned the term culture of driving having changed, Dr. Comfer nodded in recognition. I'm going to ask you about that when we come back from the break, Dr. Comfer. We're talking about traffic and the goal that Charlotte has of lowering traffic fatalities to zero by 2030 and where we stand and why we are being impeded by the increased speed of drivers on our roads, among other things. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about traffic safety and Charlotte's goal of lowering traffic fatalities to zero by 2030 with Julie Eisel, Charlotte Mayor Pro Tem, and the chair of the Transportation and Planning Committee. Eli Portillo is Assistant Director of Outreach and Research at UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute, and Dr. Wes Comfer is an Engineering Research Associate at UNC Chapel Hill's Highway Safety Research Center. And just a moment ago, Dr. Comfer, Julie Eisel was talking about how the culture of driving has changed here in Charlotte in recent years. Last year, the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer cooperated on a series called Death in the Fast Lane, which examined speeding in the state and how the number of people driving 20, 30, 40 miles or more per hour over the speed limit was increasing. When roads were empty during the pandemic, there was more incidences of people speeding and going faster than they might normally have driven, and that has continued during the pandemic. You nodded in recognition when she talked about the culture of driving changing. What do you think she meant, and is this an example of it?
So there is a thrust in the traffic safety research world to understand what we call traffic safety culture. And traffic safety culture doesn't have a clear definition. And I apologize, I'm not a sociologist. That's the second kind of thing I've told you I'm not this morning, commenting on other topics. But
what exactly are you? I'm just kidding.
traffic safety culture is sometimes talked about as a collective force of norms and beliefs within an area that sort of dictate the way that people use the roadway. And so if you think about a culture of driving, it's worth considering how has speeding become the social norm? And it does seem that maybe some social norms shifted a little bit during the pandemic. An element to maybe consider there as well is the fact that restraint use, after having achieved about 90% all over the place, you know, 90% of people wearing seatbelts. We're all familiar with the clicker ticket social norming campaigns. That seemed to shift during the pandemic as well. So maybe some of these risky behaviors that are part of a traffic safety culture, the social norm shifted. Maybe one question to ask.
Julie, you are the politician here. So as I was getting ready for this program yesterday, it occurred to me that if you're right about this culture of driving changing, it seems to go along with the culture in the country changing. We suddenly have this me attitude. There's no regard for the social welfare of all of us. It's about me and my rights and you not telling me what I can and cannot do. Belting up in the car, driving at the speed limit, is you telling me what I have to do, and by God, I'm not doing it.
That's the way it feels sometimes. If you're in a lane and you're going the speed limit or a couple miles over and the guy behind you is right on your tail because he's in a hurry and he needs to get there more than you do. And it just feels like that we're not, we're really not looking out for each other.
Yeah, I think this isn't the only kind of risky behavior we've seen increase during the pandemic. You know, unfortunately, there are nationwide statistics about record drug overdose deaths, increases in alcohol overuse. So we are seeing, I think, during COVID and the aftermath, I don't want to go out on a limb and say just nihilism, but people in some ways are behaving in more risky ways. And that's reflected not just in traffic deaths, but in other behaviors. But this also predates COVID. This has been rising in Charlotte for a while. And I think we have to talk about the enforcement part of that, too. It's been well reported by WFAE, the Charlotte Observer, Charlotte Ledger, and others that traffic tickets for speeding, you know, and other causes in Charlotte have been going down for a while. Steve Harrison, I believe, did a really good story on how, you know, that trend is going down, but also expired registrations aren't being clocked. You know, I counted earlier this week when I was driving, in a 5-minute stretch, I saw 6 vehicles with headlights out at night, which I have not seen before. And I just think we've seen enforcement go down a lot. And that might be contributing to the sense that, I mean, it doesn't matter how I drive, nothing's going to happen.
Well, there's the lack of accountability at almost every level right now, and it's front and center on television every day. You can see that nobody's paying the price for anything that they do, so why can't I drive 90 miles per hour down Moorhead Street. I referenced that story that the News and Observer and the Charlotte Observer did a moment ago, Death in the Fast Lane by Ames Alexander and Gavin Off, who reported the story for this side of the equation here in Charlotte. In that, they say that when people are charged with driving 20 miles per hour or more over the speed limit, nearly 92% get breaks in the courts that allow them to avoid the full penalties. In some counties, fewer than 2% of extreme speeders are convicted as charged. Julie, do you know what's happening in our courts?
Sure, absolutely. It's what's been happening in our courts for a long time. It's why I got into politics, into elected office. When I first started looking at the data, we were 50th in the country in courtroom funding. So, you know, it's really hard to understand how these folks are getting off and don't have to face penalties through a court system. But when you have a 2.5 year homicide backlog, they're not taking court cases for traffic infractions. But there's other solutions that I feel like could take the pressure off the court system and take the pressure off the police department. Our police department is down a couple hundred officers. Frankly, it's really tough to recruit people who want to be a police officer right now. And if you do, they're working on, again, on homicides and violent crime. They're not sitting on street corners waiting to catch speeders. It's difficult. We could be using technology, but our hands are tied on that, frankly.
Some of this predates the pandemic, but Eli, some have theorized that last year during the pandemic, a different type of person might have been driving on our roads than, or at least they made up the bulk of the population driving on our roads. They were younger because they had jobs that would not allow them to stay home so that they were on the roads, or they didn't want to stay home because they're young people. According to Arthur Goodwin, who I think works with Dr. Comfer, he's a psychologist and colleague at the UNC Highway Safety Research Center, young people are more likely to drive faster and are less likely to wear seatbelts, which was also a contributing factor to the rise in fatalities. Others have said that cars are now built for speed. I can tell you from experience that the car I drove in the 1970s and 80s was much worse on the road than the car I'm driving today. Are we being lulled, Eli, into a false sense of security that these machines are solid, rock solid, and they'll, like a cocoon, they will protect us?
You know, I'm certainly, I'm going to be the one to declaim that I'm not an expert on that right now, but I do think that, yeah, to some degree, for sure, you know, you buy a new car nowadays and you've got lane assist that tells you if you're drifting, you've got backup cameras. Some cars have automatic braking for, you know, the front if you're getting too close to an object. You have cars with features like autopilot in Teslas. I mean, the safety features are better than they've ever been. At the same time, you've also got giant screens, you've got cell phones, you know, you've got, I think, psychologically the ability to say, yeah, this thing practically drives itself and you don't necessarily have to pay attention. The car that I grew up and was raised in, driving in, not living in, was an 86 Honda Accord. And, you know, that had one front airbag, no side airbags, no, I'm sure the safety features were terrible. It was a stick shift, but you really had to pay attention when you were driving that. That's the car, you know, that I learned to drive in, and you couldn't take your eyes off the road, because if you did, I mean, it was an old car with a stick shift, you'd probably stall. So that could well be part of it. Also, and Dr. Comfort can talk more about this, but cars are bigger than they used to be. I mean, compare a car from the mid 80s to a car now, they're enormous. Just look at two, Accords next to each other. Look at the SUVs and pickup trucks that make up almost 3/4 of new vehicles sold. We are buying enormous cars that carry enormous amounts of kinetic energy. And when you ram an object that big at 80 miles per hour into another object that big going 80 miles per hour, people are going to die.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, Dr. Comfort, because it never even occurred to me, because I learned to drive on a 1960-something Buick Electra or a Delta 88 or something. It was a boat. It was so big. I don't think you could park it today in an average space. But that was a lighter car, probably on average, than some of these honking SUVs that are on the road. They are tanks. Is that causing part of the problem?
part of the problem is also the grill height. So it's not just the heavy mass and the horsepower and speed, but how high off the ground the vehicle sits. If you strike someone in an SUV, you know, they're not going to roll over it like they would in your old boat, maybe. And they might get pulled under, or if they're not already dead from a chest injury, unfortunately. So just the grill height is problematic. And I believe it was the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety did a study that showed that the involvement of SUVs in crashes has gone up over time.
It's one thing when speeding occurs on interstates. It's another when it happens in residential areas. And Julie, are we hearing from residents? Are you hearing from constituents that people are being more reckless in terms of speeding through neighborhoods, which seem to have four-way stops now at every single intersection, or speed humps, or both?
It's hard to get speed humps anymore because it's difficult for emergency vehicles to navigate speed humps. But yes, we do have a program where neighborhoods can apply to lower the speed limit. If they're not a main thoroughfare, they can apply to lower the speed limit on their
street. But are people paying attention? Are they paying attention to those lower speed limits? That's my question. Are they speeding through neighborhoods?
I think they're still speeding through neighborhoods. Okay. I mean, on Queens Road West right now, the neighbors all have these signs up that say, please slow down. And I drove it this morning, and everybody's going 10 miles over the speed limit.
So Brian on Facebook writes, everyone speeds. School buses, police, city workers, the police and other people in authority should set an example, but don't. Is that a problem that you see, Julie Eisel?
Everyone speeds. Yes.
You said that.
And you know, I mean, to be honest, if you're driving, you're moving along with traffic, right? I catch myself sometimes. I didn't check to see what the speed limit was, but I'm moving along with traffic on the road. And all of a sudden you look and you see you're going over the speed limit. When everybody's going that, you know, that fast, it becomes the new norm.
Well, let me ask you this, Dr. Comfort. She's right about that. Very right about that. And sometimes you're going 15 or 20 miles an hour over the speed limit on a surface road, a city street, but you're flowing with the traffic. Does that tell us something about the inaccuracy of the posted speed limit? Is it too low?
Oh man, posted speed limits and just speed limit setting is a very complex topic, and it is one that deals with both legal ramifications and engineering data. I will say a lot of the ways that engineers approach speed limit setting is related to what they call the 85th percentile speed, or what is, you know, 85% of the traffic traveling at. And if you can think of it as an escalation, if the 85th percentile speed is, say, 5 miles per hour over the posted speed limit. So let's say the posted speed limit is 25 miles per hour. If you find that the 85th percentile speed during an engineering study is 30 miles per hour, maybe you then raise the speed limit to 30 miles per hour. A year goes by, people have adjusted to that new posted speed limit. You escalate, you measure that 85th percentile speed. Oh, it's 35 now. And we actually see this pattern repeat. And it's why the National Association of City Transportation Officials, NACTO, has put out some guidelines saying, hey, don't use 85th percentile speed for speed limit setting. Think about risk. Think about conflicts between vehicles and pedestrians. Think about the activity that you want to foster on your roadway design.
Go ahead, Eli, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think, you know, we'll talk a little more about design probably, but one way that I've been thinking about this is, you know, roads like Carmel Road, Sardis Road, West Boulevard and East Boulevard, where part of the road goes, has four lanes and part of it has two lanes. You know, if you're driving at the speed limit of 40 miles per hour on the four lane part of Sardis Road, you feel like you are a turtle being passed by everyone. People are flying past you going 55, 60 because the road is wide. It's two lanes in each direction. It has a median down part of it and it's easy to fly. If you go 55 or 60 down the two lane part of Sardis, you feel like you're going to fly off the road and die. It's the same road, the same speed limit, you know, less than a half mile in between the two sections. And the appropriate speed to go feels totally different based on the design of the road, not just based on the posted speed limit.
Well, let's talk about that. because one of you mentioned, I think it was you, Dr. Comfort, that if you have trees lining the road, that telegraphs a signal. If you have friction, houses, driveways, sidewalks, that telegraphs to the driver that you maybe ought to slow down. This is a neighborhood street, and the conditions are not 60 miles an hour. They're more like 25 miles an hour. And The Atlantic published an article last month about what they called the deadly myth that human error causes most car crashes. The author, who's a visiting fellow at Harvard University, concentrating on urban mobility and technology, says the fault lies with our road and traffic systems, not with individuals. In Europe, they have more people than we have here in the United States, and traffic deaths dropped by 36% in 10 years because European regulators pushed car makers to build vehicles that are safer. I don't know what this means for pedestrians and cyclists, and governments regularly adjust road designs after a crash to reduce the likelihood of a recurrence. So Charlotte's roads were designed at a time when there was much smaller population and many fewer cars on the road. Is that playing a role in this, Dr. Comfort? And can we afford to redesign these roads?
I think in the United States, we have for decades prioritized automobility, people driving versus other modes of transportation. I think that is one of the benefits that you have in Europe is their land development it's just different than we have in the US. It is very much facilitating people getting around by foot, by transit, by bike. And we don't necessarily have that approach, and we haven't historically had that approach in the US. I think it's worth considering when you have transportation funding in, are you using that transportation funding to add new lanes to streets that people say are congested, or are you using it to retrofit existing streets to then make them safer or more, I guess, a better fit with that visual friction and a better fit to lower speed limits?
I mean, if you're coming into if you're in an open area on a road and the road is suddenly going into a more congested area, traffic engineers generally narrow the lanes, narrow the road, bring in it a little bit, and that's a clue you should slow down. How many examples of that do we have here? Are we doing that?
I think East Boulevard is one. The redesign of East Boulevard several years ago slowed traffic. The most recent one we've had, high accident frequency zone, was Parkwood, Parkwood Avenue, considered very dangerous to ride your bike there. And that was 0.8 miles. We spent $3.7 million to put in protected bike buffers and to narrow the lanes.
We'll talk some more about that when we come back from the break with Julie Eisel, Mayor Pro Tem, Chair of the Transportation and Planning Committee, Dr. Wes Comfort from UNC Chapel Hill's Highway Safety Research Center, and Eli Portillo from the Urban Institute. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Charlotte's goal of reducing traffic fatalities to zero by 2030, and yet the number of people being injured and killed in traffic accidents here and nationwide is on the rise. Even where road redesign is feasible, and it's not always really very feasible, the cost to do so is enormous, and the time that it takes to do some of these projects make them almost seem impossible. Since 2000, CDOT, Charlotte Department of Transportation, has finished 38 street retrofit projects, most of which were designed to slow down vehicles. At that rate, if you do the math, I'm told, retrofitting just 300 of the 2,528 miles of road we have to maintain would take us to the year 2321 for us to do this. With that reality staring you in the face, Julie Eisel, where would you put our priorities?
Well, I still would put it on enforcement. I think that's a big one that I don't fully understand why we're not trying to get the General Assembly to let us do that with speed cameras. Red light cameras we can do, but it's very difficult to get that approved. By state law, we can't use speed cameras. But in addition to that, there are some lower cost ways to help do that with pedestrian intervals, pedestrian hybrid beacons, warning signs. You know, there's some lower cost ways to do that, but street design is a big part of it.
We're going to come back to enforcement in a second, but researchers, Doctor, have discovered that drivers determine on their own what the appropriate speed of a road is. The existence, as we've talked about, sidewalks, houses, things like that, cue them to travel slower. And wider roads with painted lines prompt them to go ahead and put the pedal to the metal. How it feels to you as the driver is what determines your speed. Is that too part of the problem? Is there any way around this? I mean, must we plant trees and narrow roads and put up signs and blinking lights everywhere? Why isn't a posted speed limit enough anymore?
Well, changing the speed limit can have some effect. There have been some studies that have shown that. I think Boston did an evaluation of lowering citywide speed limits from 25 to 20, and it was found that that did actually reduce the traveling speed. But I would say dealing with speed limits alone is not enough because of the way that roadways are designed.
Clint on Facebook writes, "We need to humanize traffic safety and then engineer around it. If we know speed is a primary contributor to fatalities, then let's adopt a 20 miles per hour is plenty attitude when thinking about speed limits and road design." You're nodding in agreement with that, Dr. Comfort. Really? 20 miles an hour? We'd never get anywhere.
Well, I guess you're hitting at a social norm, a perspective of I'm not going to be able to get anywhere, right? There's this, we all expect convenience in the way we travel. And I think this is, it brings up a broader question of what do we prioritize? Do we prioritize people's safety or do we prioritize people's convenience? And I would say in this country, we have for a long time prioritized convenience. And I think if you're going to achieve a Vision Zero, honestly, I think you have to prioritize safety.
And Brooklyn on Facebook asks, is it possible to place a limit on the speed that cars can travel? Why should a car be allowed to drive over 100? I've often wondered, why do speedometers go to 120, 130 miles an hour? Who drives that fast? Why should any car be allowed to drive at over 100 miles per hour when the speed limits may be 70? Why not place a limit on the speed for cars like they use in large trucks? Can you legally put speed regulators on cars that could be perhaps triggered by either traffic conditions or some signal or pulse that the traffic engineers send out on certain roads? Is that even possible? Is it even legal? Doctor, I'm not sure you know the answer, but I'm just asking.
I don't know the answer to that, to be honest with you.
Well, I will say Google, when you have Google Maps up, they'll tell you the speed limit of the road you're on. They'll show you your speed. So, I mean, the technology exists to match speed of your vehicle to speed limit of the road you're on. I mean, just look at the political furor we've seen over masks and now vaccines. I think if you put big tech driven speed limiters in cars, people would not take kindly to it. Mm-hmm.
Joseph on Facebook writes, richest nation on earth can't afford to fix our infrastructure. Then where's all the money? Well, they just tried to put a big infrastructure bill through Congress, and it got through, but not to the tune that it was originally planned. And I think you should ask your politicians about what their priorities are. Julie, let's talk about something else. It's a we had red light cameras for a while in Charlotte. Were they effective?
Eli probably has more recent data on this. I think, Eli, that was in your story. They were effective, but the law said that the money has to go to the school system, and it cost millions of dollars to store the data, and so it became cost ineffective at some point.
Let's back up a bit, because those red light cameras were owned by a third party company. The city essentially leased them and paid a fee to the company. And the legislature or the courts decided at some point that 90% of the revenue generated by red light cameras had to go to education, leaving 10% to fund the cameras. Not enough money for the revenue coming in. Why was that decision reached, and by whom, under what set of rules did that happen?
So there was a court ruling in response to a challenge from a driver in High Point, I believe. And the court determined that under state law, automated camera enforcement was legal, but the revenue had to be distributed that way. So, you know, Charlotte had red light cameras, but for a briefer time, Charlotte actually had speed cameras. And these were not true automated speed cameras. They had to have a police officer present in a van to write and verify and write those citations. So they weren't like the speed cameras in, you know, Montgomery County, Maryland, Silver Spring, where I'm from. But there have been some interesting studies. You know, most of those tickets in the mid-2000s were on roads like Billy Graham, Independence, South Tryon. And studies, I think, from NC State after that program ended, found a durable effect for at least 2 years of people reducing speeding, especially speeding over 10 miles per hour, and a reduction in injuries and collisions where those speed camera programs were in place. So, you know, given the fact that the technology is out there for automated cameras, they don't give you points on your license. They don't raise your insurance. They just, you drive past them and you're speeding, click, boom, you're getting a $50 ticket in the mail. That's how it is in Silver Spring, Maryland, where I'm from. You just know, oops, I can't speed on this road. It's not possible. I wonder why Charlotte doesn't push more for that and explore that option, because we are hearing about not enough police, and why not automate it?
We're a Dillon rule state, and we have to get the permission of the legislature, which seems ridiculous, but it's true. So Julie, you have said that we should absolutely be pursuing the reinstatement of red light cameras, but we've been spending most of the hour talking about speeding causing all these fatalities. Should we not turn our attention to speed cameras and forget about the red light cameras?
We have to go through a very formal process of putting that on our legislative agenda. And then where does that fall on our legislative agenda in terms of priorities and what we're asking from Raleigh? So you wouldn't think it would be as difficult, but it is, because nowhere in the state do they allow speed cameras. Whereas there's already a way to get red light cameras done. They do it in Raleigh. Now you can cut a deal with the school district in terms of being able to recoup some of the cost to cover the enforcement cost, the technology cost.
So you're saying it's economically feasible to reinstate them this time as opposed to when we took them out, because it wasn't.
For red light cameras, it's legislatively feasible. Economically is a whole different question. If you're saying, well, gosh, they're too expensive, I would argue it's a lot more expensive to redesign streets for speed. You know, when you can have cameras that can be moved to different locations. And I think, you know, regardless of who's paying their tickets or if they're going to court or not, if you know there's a camera there, I do think it's going to change behavior. And
really? I mean, what difference will it make if you have posted speed limit signs and occasionally a police officer will pull you over and write you a ticket, and then, Eli, you go to court and plead it down? Won't the same thing happen with speed cameras or red light cameras? You'll plead it down, you'll get off with a slap on the wrist and go off on your merry way to repeat that activity again.
So the way the speed camera citations generally work in other locations is, you know, it's not a court issue where you go to court like a speeding ticket here. You just get the bill, you're the registered owner of the car, it's $50, you have to pay. No ifs, ands, or buts. Like I was saying, I'm from Silver Spring. I still drive home there.
And you have no record. Hold on here. Since you're bringing up Silver Spring, and I lived there for a while.
I know. That's why I did it.
All right. Thank you. You have no recourse as a driver. You get a ticket in the mail. You have to pay it. You can't go to court. You can't challenge it.
At least the programs I'm familiar with, it's $50. It's not a ticket that gives you points on your license or raises your insurance. It's just a $50 bill, basically. Right. And your car was speeding. It was photographed. You get the photograph. That's that. After that happens a couple times, you just learn, well, I can't speed on Wayne Avenue. I have to go 35 there.
So Chris tweets, as a doctor working at Charlotte's only level one trauma center, I see drunk and impaired driving as possibly the biggest cause of rising motor vehicle deaths in our city. We haven't talked about the incidents of drunk driving. What do you know about that, Julie? Is it a major problem here?
I don't know about that. We don't, because I don't feel like we're really dissecting this issue. We're not getting into who's speeding and what's causing the accidents as much. CDOT might have more information on that, but okay. I do not.
NPR reports that while most states are tough on drunk drivers, and they certainly do add to accidents, as Chris just said in his email, and injuries and fatalities, speeders in those same states actually cause the most deadly car crashes. And yet when they get caught, they get off easy. And in this state, many times, super speeders going 20, 30, 40, 50 miles per hour over the speed limit are caught doing it again and again and again. Doctor, from your experience and what you know about what happens here, do we have a functioning system designed to make our roads safer, or do we just turn the other cheek?
I think the statistics say that we probably don't have a functioning system that operates safely. And I think Eli hinted at making speed cameras, making the system administrative versus criminal to make it much more automated. And my understanding is that is what a lot of other countries do as well, and why they've had such success with their programs. But I think all this goes back to, how do we want people to get around on the roadway? What do we want to prioritize? What do we value as Americans? And I don't want people to die as they're traveling around. And so if that means redesigning roadways to help people drive slower, if that means using technologies equitably to help people drive slower, I think we need to be willing to take some of those steps.
And I think that really gets at a tension, which is, Charlotte is trying to do that. Charlotte is trying to build out a transit system, redesign more roads. But in the case, for example, of the Charlotte Moves transit plan, you know, you're talking about a 20 plus year time frame there. So in the interim, you know, what are we going to do until we get to a city where you don't need to get in a car for most trips? Are we going to accept 80, 100 people a year dying, or are we going to try some different short-term actions while we try to build those long-term solutions? And I think that's where we're really stuck right now.
The city's Department of Transportation has been doing some things, like trying to make streets safer by installing flashing beacons at pedestrian crosswalks and putting up mobile displays that tell you how fast you are driving right now, and other forms of enforcement. But some of these other forms of enforcement seem to have been glossed over. In 2009, CMPD wrote 97,000 citations for traffic violations. That fell to 44,000 in 2018, dropped to 33,000 last year. And part of the reason enforcement became more lax has to do with a shift in approach by CMPD, Julie. Chief Johnny Jennings says the department cannot return to the old approach of no tolerance policing. And this shift in attitudes has not only lowered the rate of speed enforcement, it's lowered the number of arrests overall by 46% in the last decade. Would it be worth shifting back to being tougher on drivers? And if you don't see a cop sitting by the side of the road, you feel free to go as fast as you want to. If that's the case, would it be worth shifting back?
Well, I think it has to be. You have to look at why Chief Jennings said that. And it's the people that are being stopped, there's a disproportionate relationship between people of color and white people. And that's a lot of what he's talking about. The other side of that is there's more calls for service in some of those neighborhoods. So CMPD will tell you they're there and that's where they see it. That's why I think looking at using technology makes sense, because it takes the subjectivity out of it, if you will. And we know CMPD doesn't have the personnel. If they can get qualified police officers, we want them working on, again, the most egregious cases out there. And I think we've got to look at ways we can help CMPD with traffic enforcement, help ourselves.
I have 30 seconds left. We've been talking about speeding and red light cameras and systemic problems, but it does come down to somewhat to responsibility. Is the city looking into this? Because this seems to be all over the country in every level of politics. Are they looking into how we can restore some sense of civic responsibility? We're all in this together. I have 10 seconds.
I would hope so, but that's a big question.
Okay, well, you'll get the last word because I don't think anybody has the answer. Eli Portillo from the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute, Dr. Wes Kumpfer, Engineering Research Associate with UNC Chapel Hill's Highway Safety Research Center, and Julie Iselt, Mayor Pro Tem for the City of Charlotte. Thank you all for the hour. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.